Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen. It's the 26th of August, 2015. And I've been on kind of a run of topics, starting with why do we practice? And then I talked about that a few times. And you can get the talks on my website under the heading Buddhist Wisdom. You can just find them there on my site. And they're freely available for download. Then I started focusing more on what we practice. And now tonight I want to start moving more into where do we practice. And it's interesting that if you take a look at the Noble Eightfold Path, that aspect of Buddhism and the Four Noble Truths, the fourth of the Four Noble Truths, the path, the second element that's typically listed is wise or right intention. And what does wise intention consist of? It's the intention of non-greed, non-lust, non-covetousness of the pleasant. It's also the intention of non-ill will, not having negative intentions toward other people, such as envy or jealousy or vengeance, or angry punishment. And the third element of wise intention is non-harming. We don't harm others, and we don't harm ourselves. It's interesting that two of the three elements of wise intention have to do with dealing with negative experiences, quote unquote, experiences that are fearful, angry, sad, shame, we feel ashamed, inadequate perhaps, or we feel hurt. And also, two of the three clearly have to do with our relationships with other people in terms of where do we practice. And also in terms of where, the where of negative reactions to others. It's interesting also that there's a fairly well-known statement about what the Buddha said, although we don't know what he said, actually, but there's a lot that's been said about what he said. And in this passage, he's talking with his primary attendant, Ananda, who also was his cousin, a younger man who became, as I said, the Buddha's primary attendant. And Ananda was looking around the gathering of fellow practitioners, the people they were hanging out with, participating with, you know, where they were. And Ananda looked out and said to the Buddha, look at all these people, all these relationships. This is half of the holy life, other people. The implication being that the other half was what we do inside our own heads. And the Buddha is said to have said, famously, not so, Ananda, not so. This out here, the field of our relationships with others, is the whole, the entirety of the holy life. That's really quite a powerful statement. I think it's important to not take it utterly literally. I mean, there are places to practice that are really about our relationship with ourselves completely unilaterally and internally, even without reference to an internalized other. But for the Buddha to talk about and emphasize so much the field of relatedness as a very, very primary field of practice, and to focus so much on dealing with our negative reactions to other people as certainly a large fraction of, if not the majority of, wise intention is really quite striking. So as a way into this exploration of practicing with our negative reactions with other people, I'd like to talk about an argument I had with my wife this morning. I'll spare you some of the gory details and protect the innocent. I know, every people. But quite realistically, so, and I want to use it to illustrate what I think of as four practical takeaways to invite you to consider. Just even one might be useful for you. And as a way into this, I invite you to think of a relationship you have or a recent situation in which you had what we might call negative reactions to other people. I don't mean negative like bad, but I mean it more like unpleasant emotions, typically in the range of you know, fear, anger, sadness, or shame. That's kind of the major spectrum of negative emotions, so-called. Or desires for that had to do with resisting whatever was unpleasant, wanting it to, you know, angry reactions to it or fearful reactions to it, just wanting it to go away. So think about someone who bugs you or you're aggravated with. You could love them dearly. That's often really where the action is. But something that's real for you. Maybe it was a stranger who, you know, made a rude gesture to you while with the middle finger of one hand while they were driving next to you on the freeway. Maybe it's your in-laws. It could be your kids, somebody. Okay. So the context was not very important, although it kind of illustrates it. We've had a pond in our backyard that was there when we arrived, and when we started renting our house, which we eventually bought some years ago. And I like my pond. I think it was my pond. Notice the possessive pronoun. I like my pond a lot. And I've acquired a kind of PTSD related to it leaking, because it's kind of a hassle to figure out how to plug a leak in a pond. And I love my, notice, little fishies and all my fantasies about my little pond. You get the deal. So we're now fixing the pond. It's complicated, replacing it, dealing with other things. This isn't my wife's deal. Ponds, whatever. So we now have a problem, which is that this pond, which we've invested in fixing and some expense and hassle, seems to have acquired, oh no, a leak, a little leak that's hard to find. And so I want to do various things to resolve this leak and have my pond be perfect and work permanently. My perfect permanent pond. Wow. Is there trouble? Are you kind of seeing the storm clouds brewing on the horizon, maybe? All right. And so I'm in the middle of my planning about it. I'm kind of frustrated about it. I'm sort of embarrassed that this thing that I'm involved with is not working perfectly. My wife's kind of irritated with the pond. She could care less, really. It's the pond. And so I'm, you know, telling her my plans for dealing with the leak, which are kind of a hassle, involve dealing with water and stuff like that. And she starts giving me helpful advice. And you know what was really annoying about her advice? It was correct. That really irritated me. So I had some negative reactions arising. So that was the context of it. And wisely, hopefully, a little bit of result of some practice, I didn't act like a complete jerk. You know, I had enough presence of mind to notice that my inner dashboard was starting to move from green to yellow to red. I didn't want to be an idiot, so I managed my speech mostly inside the frame of wise speech, but it was aggravating. Okay? Has anyone had an experience like that anywhere in your entire life? All right. So we walked away, and it was fairly peaceful in the outer presences. Internally, actually, it's interesting to generalize about gender in a way that is, obviously tricky, but it might be relevant to you. Studies on heterosexual couples, men and women, who are asked to have an argument in the laboratory of the university while being hooked up to lie detector type stuff, so they're measuring their physiology. One of the really classic findings, as a generalization, many exceptions, is that the man is outwardly calm. Yeah, we should think more about that. Yes, and the woman tends to be more animated, more expressive, hands moving, but inwardly, she's relatively calm. Her heart's not beating that much faster. Her blood pressure's not that rising. And he's redlining all over the place. Oh, yeah. You know, inside. And then also, she comes, even if she gets an elevation, she comes back to baseline much more quickly. But he's like, for hours afterward. So I don't know if that fits any of you. I suspect it fits my wife and me. Okay, so there's the setup, right? So here are four suggestions. What do you do? Right? What do you do with it? And especially in the context of locating practice right where the rubber meets the road, Actually, part of the issue was that the rubber wall of the pond has sprung a leak, you know, right where the rubber meets the leak. How do you practice right there? Okay? So I'm going to offer kind of four suggestions, including related to my own process about this. The first one is to track, as the Buddha has taught, the feeling tone or hedonic tone of experience. Pay a lot of attention to the sense of things being pleasant or, in this case, unpleasant. And to realize that we actually don't usually react to external events. We react to our experience of external events, right? I was getting irritated. I was getting frustrated. I was feeling embarrassed. I was worried this wasn't going to work. So I was hitting all four of the negative emotions, you know, irritation, anger, anxiety, this wasn't work, fear, embarrassment, shame, and also a kind of sadness, a sort of anticipatory disappointment. Ugh, this is not going to turn out as I'd hoped, right? And so then, rather than being super relaxed and happy about feeling a surge of miserableness inside, I wanted it to go away. So I wanted to make it go away by making her go away. Her point of view, her words, her annoyingly accurate logical take on things, go away. But really, what I wanted to go away was my own internal state. I wanted my state to change. So the Buddha, interestingly, allocated one of the four elements of his primary teachings about mindfulness to mindfulness of our own internal reactions, but particularly positive and negative ones, or a sense of things being pleasant, I want to chase it, or unpleasant, in this case, related to other people. So just that process of bringing the focus internal. Oh, it's about the internal reactions that I'm having that I'm trying to change, right, or manage. That's a very powerful moment. And to have some insight into what is actually so unpleasant about this. It's not a huge problem. The worst case, we fill the pond with dirt, plant grass, and move on. You know, it's what our kids call a first world problem. It's pretty trivial. It's a minor thing. It's a minor tiff between us. Why is this so unpleasant? What is this stirring up inside me? What's my PTSD with my 20-year history of my pond, you know? Okay, is that kind of clear, the first one? Tracking the unpleasantness inside our minds that are stimulated by others, associated with other people, and then watch what our minds do with the unpleasant arising inside ourselves and bring the locus of focus into ourselves. Do what we need to do appropriately around assertiveness, drawing lines. I said some useful things to her, I think, whatever, but mostly deal with it inside. I mean, is that kind of clear? Really tracking, paying a lot of attention to unpleasant and appreciating that it's our minds we're reacting to. It's a little bit of a not perfect analogy, but there's a Zen story that kind of illustrates this point as well. Two monks are walking past a flag that's, you know, in the breeze, and one monk says, "Look, the flag is moving." The second monk thinks to one-up the first monk and says, "No, it's the wind that's moving." And the third monk walking by one-ups both of them, and he says, "No, you're both wrong. It's your mind that's moving." Something kind of deep about that. It's to track our own minds as they move rather than blaming the other for what's happening inside ourselves. Second kind of suggestion or takeaway is to watch craving. It's so interesting. In the moment, I could feel a lot of craving inside me for things to change, an intensity of desire or wanting. I wanted it to change inside. And I wanted the views inside me, the ideas or worries inside me to change. And I was driven around that. So it's not just noticing unpleasantness, let's say, related to other people, and bringing awareness internally, practicing internally. But it's to also track the intensity of craving or drivenness that comes up around that sort of thing, including the craving to have what was happening in the other person's mind change. If you just kind of think about all the wackiness that rolls through your mind, own mind, all the crazy ideas, at least that much wackiness rolls through the minds of other people. And they get, you know, that's how attached we get? I can't believe you thinking that. I can't believe that's how you see it, right? I can't believe that that was the reaction that arose in you at that moment. And I'm going to pin that reaction on you and beat you up for that one for days to come. Right, we get very caught up in reifying, essentializing, thingifying, stabilizing transient, fairly trivial, wacky mental events in the minds of other people. And then we get caught up in craving about what's happening in their minds, rather than realizing a lot of the time, it doesn't matter very much what happens in their minds. We have our own practice. We have our own code of virtue, our own code of integrity. We know what we're going to do. Honestly, kind of mostly turn off the recorder. Kind of whatever my wife thinks about this, this is not at the level where we both have to decide about it. I get to kind of decide. I know what I'm going to do about it. I don't need to get all caught up in her thinking a certain way about it. Right? And this is my wife, my precious wife. Think about all the reactions in the minds of other people we get caught up in. The 30% of the Republicans in the country who are in favor of Donald Trump. You know, just think about all the mental activity about what's in their minds, about the mind of another person, a year and a half before we have an election, right? Or, yeah, just a year and a quarter. Okay, got it so far? Craving, including craving about mental events in other people, okay? Third, another Dharma story again. The Buddha had some monks wandering around, alms around. They went to other towns. They came back and they said, man, those people in those other villages insulted us and they threw dirt clods at us, essentially. And we're really angry at them. And can you basically make them stop doing that? Okay? And the Buddha said, whoa, wait a second here. If you're practicing my way, the way that I teach, you need to sustain loving kindness, compassion and kindness and goodwill instead of ill will. Remember, not ill will, one of the three main aspects of wise intention. Goodwill toward other people, even if they insult you. Even if, and then he started raising the bar. Even if they throw dirt clods at you, even if they insult your parents, even if, and then this is the famous metaphor, even if bandits were to grab you and cut your limbs off with a wooden saw, like, wow. Someone who cannot sustain loving kindness radiating in all directions in that situation is not practicing my way. That's pretty extreme. But I figure if the Buddha is telling us to sustain loving kindness to people even as they cut your arms off, he didn't say, don't try to get away. Don't, you know, call the police, stuff like that. But what's in our heart, right? If the Buddha's advising me to have loving kindness for someone who's cutting my arm off, at least I can sustain loving kindness for my sweet wife who's annoyingly right about how we ought to deal with our pond. Right? So think about that, the sustaining of that for their sake, but actually primarily for your sake. I noticed for myself, as soon as in my own practice, I could locate compassion for her. She's at the tail end of a migraine. She is a little irritable. It's true. It's not her fault. Okay? Just knowing that, right? Having that compassion. Or realizing that it doesn't really matter what she says. I can still find love in my heart. Right, not just for my mate, but also for other people, even people whose politics are not my own. Can we expand that circle of us to include the whole wide world? Can we radiate loving kindness in all directions, under all conditions, even in the middle of being upset? I find for myself, I'd never get free in an interpersonal upset until two things happen for sure. One, I locate my own maximum reasonable personal responsibility, whatever it is, including nothing, but usually there's something there. And second, I'm never free of the upset until I find compassion for the other person. Compassion, loving kindness for the other person. I may want to have nothing to do with them again. I may realize I don't really trust them again. Or I may realize, you know, I'm just not into life the way you are. You're over there. But if I can't locate compassion, even if I feel alongside that compassion, they really did wrong me. If I can't locate compassion for them, I don't really feel freed up. I'm still carrying that upset around. Yeah. There's another Zen story. It's, again, a little tangential, but it's a great story. Two monks who have intense vows of celibacy come to a muddy river, and a beautiful princess is standing there in her lovely robes. And the senior monk says to her, Princess, would you like me to carry you across the river? She says, oh, thank you. So he lifts her up and carries her across the river. The younger monk follows behind, but he starts stewing for the next mile or two. He thinks to himself, we had vows of celibacy. What was he thinking, right? He's thinking about what that other person is thinking. How could he hold her in his arms, feeling the soft roundness of her thighs and her legs against himself? How could he be smelling her beautiful hair? How could he be glancing at her lovely robes as he was carrying her across the river? You know, finally the younger monk bursts out and says, how could you do all these things? And the senior monk turns to him and says, I set her down on the other side of the river. You've been carrying her ever since in your own mind, right? Well, we're carrying, right? I myself, and I think it's generally true, we're carrying other people around, even those who've wronged us, let's say, until we find loving kindness and compassion for them. So that's the third suggestion. And then the fourth one in practice, and it's the deeper end of the pool. If it's just intellectual, that's a good beginning. But increasingly, it's to have the felt recognition that, in a sense, for lack of a better word, all upsets are empty. They're empty of absolute self-existence. Everything, in a sense, at a certain level, is like everything else. Pond, not pond, right? Rick's view, Jan's view, my wife. Right, wrong. In a sense, everything's like everything else, because it has the same deep nature. It's made up of parts, it's transient, it arises dependently, it's ownerless, it's all part of the same fabric of totality, right? And at that level, if you can get to that level, it's maybe like a bird's eye view, not that level as what John Wellwood called a spiritual bypass, as some people do. They go so cosmic, they don't know how to balance their own checkbook, right? Or they use it as a way to avoid processing their real feelings and working things through in intimacy and vulnerability with other people. But I mean it in a genuine way, where you can kind of go to a higher level, of larger perspective, and you can see the oneness of everything so that the parts that have been struggling with each other at a lower level don't have the same upsetting traction in your mind. Okay, four suggestions, right? In a context of really valuing opportunities to practice with people who irritate you. How cool is that? Life is full of opportunities, right? To practice with people who irritate you or frustrate you or don't give you what you want or don't attune empathically perfectly. Okay, stop. What do you think?
Did you fix the pond?
I'm working on it. I'm working. I'm on the path. Thanks for asking. And it's a great pond. And I love my little fishies. Okay, good. Well, we may need to talk. Okay, yeah, in the back there.
Yeah, it's kind of a technical question, but I know what you're talking about, craving things to be different.
Yeah.
And I wonder how that, with maybe differ from aversion to what's happening? Because I usually think of aversion is, but you sort of framed it a little differently.
Okay. So. Yeah. It's good to kind of tease apart the threads of the fabric of the mind stream. It's helpful, right? And so in the Buddha's analysis, he talks about what he calls contact, where there's just the beginning of a mental event. There's a sound, there's a word, there's a pure stimulus. At that point, in the first half second of the processing stream, it doesn't have a lot of valence to it. It's not pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and we're not moved to avoid the unpleasant or, pardon me, approach the pleasant, right? And then about a half second or a second later, things start to acquire a hedonic tone or a feeling tone in the language of Buddhism as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And I would suggest, in some ways, especially for us as a deeply social species, experiences can have a quality of, we could say, heartfelt, that seems to be something more than just some combination of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Okay? Then our response to that begins, where we crave the unpleasant to go away, right? So we fight it, or we flee from it, or we kind of freeze and appease it to make it go away, or we dissociate from it to make it go away, right? Or we have greed, as it were, for the pleasant, and we want to chase it. Okay, so in that analysis, you can see the difference between the hedonic tone of an experience and the emergence of motivation, a motivated response. People often use the word, I think for me technically it's useful to separate out the feeling tone of experience from the desires, the motivated response, the wants, the wishes, the hopes, the planning, the craving and clinging, if it's problematic. That's our response to the threat value, or the threat signal of the experience as unpleasant, or the reward value or reward opportunity of the experience as pleasant. And people often use the word aversion, in my observation, for kind of a mixture of both the unpleasant and negatively valenced craving and clinging and wanting. But I think it's helpful to kind of, as you're doing right here, separate them out. So you can watch your mind, you know, right? Put your hand on the hot plate, initially there's the pure experience, contact. You put your hand in the hot water and it's hotter than you thought it was going to be, right? So the first half second, it's water, pressure, and then comes unpleasant, then comes pull away. Right? Okay. Okay?
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to explore in relationships. Often experiences are combos, kind of like hot sauce. It's sort of desirable, but it's also sort of unpleasant too in relationships. And then see what you do with that. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what works for me when I'm not so lost in my own story is to ask for help and just be vulnerable and say, you know, I need some help solving this issue. Can you help me?
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. I can't do it all the time because I'm lost in my drama. But when I can, it works really well.
Thank you. To ask for help. Yeah. Great. Yeah, back there.
They work with dreams in the same way?
Oh, you mean afterward?
Yeah.
After you wake up?
Yeah.
Oh, I think that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, briefly. So the question was, can we work with dreams in some of the same way? And I've done myself a lot with my own dreams, particularly at different times. And what I would say is that, my own personal opinion, I don't know what the Buddha ever said or was said he said about dreams, but I had a Jungian analyst for a while, and he said one way to relate to dreams is as if they are works of art, which is very interesting, and it's a very respectful attitude. So it's not so much that there's a meaning, And ultimately, it transcends meaning. And also, there's a sense of not wanting to be manipulative related to dreams. So that's been helpful for me. And as he put it once, when the unconscious knows that someone's listening, it starts communicating more. So that's interesting. The other thing, though, to more your point about working with what arises, I've definitely have done things, especially if I wake up from a very upsetting dream, I'll sometimes play with it in my imagination to explore it or maybe imagine altering parts of it or helping it have a happier ending or mobilizing resources in my own mind that were not mobilized in the dream as a way of exploring it. And so I think maybe you might want to play around with what I've brought up here. What was unpleasant? I think tracking the emotional tone of a dream is very useful. Also, I think observing desire as it's manifested in the dream. Okay? And then maybe think about the dream as, of course, everything in the dream is a part of you. And seeing what it would be like to have compassion and kindness for every single part, right? And then if it's... This would be trippy. I never thought about this, but to imagine, as I said, my fourth suggestion, that the dream, the waking, I mean, where it came to me recently was that the planet Jupiter and the sound of this water were the same. In a deep sense, they are the same. They have the same nature. And if you could do that with the dream, that's pretty far out. Anyway. Okay. I'm really interested in how do you practice, you know, where? Locating practice in the context of interactions and relationships that have for you some negative qualities. How do you do that? And what do you think of the four suggestions I've offered? Yeah.
The one about not judging what someone else is thinking.
Yeah.
In all the years I've been coming, this is the first time I remember hearing this particular thing. And it's so valuable.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, not judging what other people are thinking or getting attached to it. Yeah.
The amount of time that you spend.
Right.
Imagining what other people are thinking and then having conversations with them about how can you think that?
Yeah. I know. Isn't it weird?
Imagining what other people are thinking.
Yeah, or having imaginary conversations or thinking about how can I persuade you or make you see the light or,
Or to think that someone else is thinking that about what I'm thinking.
Yeah, that's right. It's creepy and weird. It's like, it's sort of like celebrity stalkers. Like, we're preoccupied with what they're thinking and they're preoccupied with what we're thinking and no mas.
Very, very.
Oh, that's really good. Yeah, it's really true. There's a place, obviously, for empathy and, you know, skillful persuasiveness. We take our best effort. But I think you're exactly right. Getting preoccupied and, I don't know what to call it, staticifying, thingifying, transient, complicated, you know, flickerings like the northern lights of events in the minds of other people. Kind of like, right, locking it in and going, and meanwhile, they've moved on, right? They're like, whatever, man, what? Like the monk story on the river, the princess. What? You're still uptight about that? I like have so moved on. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm thinking about this. I'm giving a Dharma talk about this event. My wife is not thinking about this right now.
The other night where I got an email from someone and it was I experienced it was very attacking. There was a lot of you know anger around it and I was getting really incensed and trying to figure out what to do. And what I was able to do was to think, well, but where is she coming from? And what I sensed into was that there was a real hurt that she felt.
Yeah.
And so was able to communicate to the place of what I thought was her hurt, but in a skillful way, in a reassuring way.
Mm.
And so rather than getting triggered, I think we often talk about, there's always something under anger.
Right.
And it is often hurt or a sense of feeling disrespected. And I thought, she feels disrespected by me, not by my intention. And so if I can respond to that hurt rather than the angry tone that it was offered, I was pleased that I was able to do that before I sent the How dare you?
Yeah. That's really beautiful. Thank you for that. Yeah, feeling below the surface, the softer parts. Yeah, that's right.
So that compassion and meta.
Yeah, having that for those other people. That's good. So, one last person, then I have a suggestion, then we'll move to an end. Yeah.
Well, having come from an experience just right before getting here, where it wasn't an argument, but it was a clash of opinion and a reaction, at least on my part.
Yeah.
Probably, or likely on the part of my partner. But, of course, I'm not sure what he felt, and so I really appreciated what you said. What I do is once I can get past my reaction of wanting to make him see what he did correctly.
Yes, you're wanting to install some mental process in him. Yep.
Is to, through compassion, but first of all, I need to take on, okay, where was I? Where was, what was my reaction? And then once I have compassion and let go, what I wind up with is a learning about how I can better communicate or how I can better listen. It really was so beneficial to have this conversation.
Oh, and relevant for you. Yeah, and you were practicing with it already before you got here.
Yes.
Yeah, good for you. Yeah, that's great. So I have a suggestion that we just take a moment here toward the end and imagine a recent unpleasant reaction for you, or a relationship maybe that is characterized by a fair number of aggravating type experiences, okay, for you, let's say. And imagine yourself, see if you can imagine yourself in whatever ways are genuine for you, authentic, orienting to that person or to that situation with a wise heart. Imagining it now. And if you like, imagining more responsibility for your own reactions, especially your reactions to the sense of things as unpleasant inside yourself. What would happen if you did that? Also, what would happen if you had less drivenness or craving, less attachment to things turning out a certain way, including in the mind of the other person? So what might happen if there was more kindness and compassion inside you for the other person? Maybe, as has been said, being more aware of their own suffering, their own hurt, worry. And then last, in whatever way is actually meaningful for you, popping up to that bird's eye view, you might think of it as the perspective of the absolute, the whole universe, 200 billion galaxies, 100 billion stars in our own galaxy, one little star in the middle of nowhere with 9 planets, one of which has a tiny, tiny pond.
Pond.
Just big picture. See if that works for you. Let's just sit for another moment or two. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Take care.